NDS, or National Intelligence Chief, a former spy master, spy chief, is also running. So it's very crowded. It's a very interesting scene, but one should not forget that the talks.
It's
in
almost
Doha,
as crowded as the Democratic president. It's almost as crowded as the Democratic presidential candidate race here in the United States for president. We're going to have to leave it there. Lakfula Nachavizadeh, I want to thank you for being with us, news director of Tolo News. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Tuesday of each month at 6:30 p.m.
What might an artist near the end of a well-lived life tell us about the creative process and the personal qualities or values they think are important for living a good life? Hi, I'm Bob Madar, inviting you to come on over to Local Folks Podcast for our last visit with Mickey and listen to him talk about what he has learned after 96 years on the planet. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, measles is back in the Pacific Northwest.
Police officers in Phoenix, Arizona will be required to document every gun draw.
And in international news, hundreds of millions of bees are dying in Brazil.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Measles might be back in Clackamas and Multnomah counties. Health officials say 23 people have contracted measles in Oregon so far this year. This number is the highest recorded since 1991. In Clackamas and Multnomah counties, there have been 9 cases in just 6 weeks. A reluctance among parents to immunize their children has led to a resurgence in the highly contagious disease. Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines said to OPB that officials have been watching a new measles outbreak in the state since July. Health officials urge parents to get their kids vaccinated. According to health officials, none of the 9 recently diagnosed individuals had been immunized. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the nation as a whole has seen about 1,200 cases across 30 states just this year. It is the worst measles outbreak in almost 30 years.
In a letter to parents and staff on Monday, Portland Public Schools announced it had mistakenly transferred $2.9 million to a fraudulent account. The account was disguised as that of a PPS construction contractor. The district was made aware of the fraud on Friday and has been working with the Portland police as well as the FBI. The bank was able to freeze the funds before the scammer withdrew the money, and PPS announced on Tuesday morning that the entire amount had been securely returned. 2 district employees are on paid administrative leave during an investigation. However, PPS said they did not commit any crimes. According to officials, the fraud appears to have come from an outside source. A cybersecurity expert said cases like this often start with a phishing email sent to someone high up in an organization or company. The email may ask them to reset their password or verify information, and then sends them to a fraudulent website. Once they enter their information, the scammers have access to their account. PPS is reviewing all of their payment procedures, and all district staff will get updated fraud awareness training to try and prevent this from happening again.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1619. That was the day that the first ship bearing enslaved people arrived in North America. It was an English warship called the White Lion that came to Johnstown in the colony of Virginia. The ship was a privateer and had captured 20-odd enslaved people from a Portuguese ship in a raid. Virginian planters were interested in forced labor to work the tobacco fields in the colony. The laws surrounding slavery in Virginia evolved over time. Throughout the 1600s, statutes replacing indentured servants to race-based slavery for life were written into the law books. In 1654, John Kaiser became the first person enslaved under the rule of law in North America. By 1662, a law was passed that children would be considered enslaved or free based on the status of their mother in Virginia. This meant that slavery could pass down from generation to generation. This and similar laws ensured slavery would grow. Historians estimate that 388,000 enslaved people came to what became the United States from Africa. Due to laws passing down slavery to children, by the Civil War, there were nearly 4 million enslaved people in the South. By the early 1800s, enslaved people made up about one-third of the Southern population. Initially, enslaved labor worked predominantly to produce crops like tobacco, indigo, and also rice. Some West Africans had developed valuable skills in rice cultivation that white landowners exploited through slavery. With the invention of the cotton gin in 1793, cotton became increasingly important to the Southern economy. The South's dependence on slave labor became more entrenched and spread westward with the growing United States until the Civil War ended the brutality of slavery.
A new report from Portland State University has found that there are many more houseless people in the region than previously estimated, and supporting them will cost much more than is currently being spent, requiring a new source of revenue to be effective. The report found that 38,000 people experienced houselessness in the Tri-County region in 2017, which is around 2% of the population. This number differs from previous counts that found less than 6,000 on a single night. The report also estimates it will require between $2.6 and $4.1 billion for housing and support in the next 10 years, compared to the $70 million budget currently in use. According to PSU Homelessness Research Action Collaborative Director Marissa Zapata, one reason the number in this report is higher than previous estimates is because it uses a broader definition of houselessness. Previous counts have only included people on the streets, in emergency shelters, and in transitional housing, while the PSU study also includes people who are temporarily living with friends or family members. The report recommends that a Tri-County Exploratory Committee or Task Force of inclusive and committed stakeholders led by a government entity be formed to examine ways to improve regional coordination around houselessness.
A new public housing project for houseless youth has opened in Vancouver. Cables Terrace will offer affordable housing units to young adults who have aged out of foster care or fallen into homelessness. The building contains 28 rent-subsidized apartments, including studio, one-bedroom, and two-bedroom units. The project is a first for the Vancouver Housing Authority, as it targets a specific population. It will cater to young adults between 18 and 24 years old, as well as their children. The three-story complex also includes a rec room, laundry, and rooftop deck. Residents in all units will pay 35% of their income as rent, and officials expect the complex will be full within a couple of months. More than half of the funding for the $8.2 million development came from low-income housing tax credits, while the rest was awarded from Vancouver's Affordable Housing Fund and profits the authority made from selling older units.
Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford.
A move for common sense gun laws heads to the states, plus will Trump judges decide a decade of civil rights? Topping our news, fired cop Daniel Pantaleo will sue the police commissioner James O'Neill and the NYPD in New York to win back his job. The New York Post. His lawyer said Monday Pantaleo filed the suit under the state civil practice law and rules. NYPD Commissioner O'Neill fired Pantaleo over the death of Eric Garner in a 2014 incident on Staten Island that fueled the Black Lives Matter movement. That when a cell phone video showed the victim repeatedly shouting, "I can't breathe." And as talk of federal gun control legislation continue in the weeks following the mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton that claimed 31 lives, some Tennessee lawmakers are pushing for what they call common sense gun laws.
Democratic Representative and Caucus Chair Michael Stewart of Nashville says there are clear steps the governor could take.
Here in this state, Governor Lee should have us implement universal background checks like Colorado and many other states have done. That's step one.
Early this year, Republican Senator Steve Dickerson introduced State Senate Bill 1178, a so-called red flag bill that would allow law enforcement to petition a court to temporarily remove a person's access to firearms if believed to be a danger to themselves or others. Lee has said it's still too early to consider such measures. Nadia Ramlagan reporting.
Facing mounting public pressure and protest outside his Louisville home, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has recently announced the Senate could possibly consider gun control legislation when lawmakers return in the fall. Meantime, a judicial watchdog group says McConnell's created an assembly line for approving conservative judges who will determine the civil rights of Americans for decades to come.
Before recessing last month, the Republican-controlled Senate confirmed 13 new judges to lifetime appointments in a two-day period. Daniel Goldberg with the Alliance for Justice says young, white, mostly male judges will rule in the rights for workers, women, the LGBTQ community, and consumer protections for the next 3 to 5 decades.
People who will use the court, who will use their position as lifetime judges to jam a radical agenda that they could not achieve otherwise onto the country.
Since President Donald Trump took office, he said 146 federal judges confirmed by the Senate, compared with 20 during President Barack Obama's last 2 years in office. I'm Roz Brown.
Earlier this year, you may recall McConnell led a vote to change the rules of debate for confirming district judges from 30 hours to 2 hours. That followed his decision to block Merrick Garland, Obama's pick for the Supreme Court, for almost a year. This is PNS. More than a year after U.S. Supreme Court ruling, some thought would deal a big blow to unions. Eric Tegedoff reports the organization showed no signs of slowing down, at least in Washington state.
The 2018 decision on Janus versus AFSCME had the potential to cut off one revenue stream to public unions, allowing employees to shirk fair share fees even as the unions continued to negotiate for them. The Olympia-based group Freedom Foundation thought this would be an opportunity to get union members to opt out of paying these fees. Peter Starzynski with the Northwest Accountability Project says that isn't how things played out.
The reality is their effort has been a failure as we've seen union membership in Washington increase. And all along the West Coast, including in Washington, unions continue to win important victories like increases in the minimum wage, paid sick leave for all, fair scheduling.
Union membership in the Evergreen State actually grew in 2018, part of a trend that began in 2014. Representation is now close to 20% of the workforce, making Washington the third most unionized state in the country, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Freedom Foundation did not respond to a request for comment on this story.
Membership in the Washington Federation of State Employees grew from 44,000 before the Janus ruling to 45,000 after that ruling. And the life expectancy for people in Wisconsin has declined for a second state year. That's according to a new report.
The nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum compiled data from the State Department of Health Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, showing increased deaths from alcohol abuse and opioids. The group's policy researcher, Mark Summerhauser, says he also noticed a troubling mortality trend among the state's black residents.
What we found is that overall mortality among black Wisconsinites did increase by about 24% within that time period from 1999 to 2017, and that was something that flew in the face of a national trend.
Mortality rates for black Americans were down by 6% during that same time period. Sommerhauser says he's unsure of the exact cause of the trend, but notes the state's opioid death rate for black people in 2017 was nearly double the national average. In Milwaukee County, the opioid death rate for all races was more than twice the statewide rate between 2013 and 2017. I'm Tramell Gomes.
The mandatory display of the motto, In God We Trust, is going to greet South Dakota students when they return to public schools on Thursday. Annie Laurie Gaylor is with the Freedom from Religion Foundation. She believes it's improper.
We think this is a very inappropriate motto because we have a godless constitution. We are not a theocracy. Nobody has to believe in God. God is no part of our government.
Congress adopted the In God We Trust motto back in 1956. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, four presidential candidates spoke at a Native American forum in Iowa, and a tribal consortium has endorsed Montana Governor Steve Bullock for president.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Author Marianne Williamson kicked off the Frank LaMare Native American Presidential Forum Monday morning in Sioux City, Iowa, where tribal leaders, elders, and directors of Native organizations questioned four presidential candidates. Williamson spoke about making amends to the Native community and said if elected president, she would take down the portrait of Andrew Jackson at the White House.
Who could have just a base level knowledge of American history, which I do, and know of Andrew Jackson's role in the Trail of Tears. It is one of the great shames, the great black marks on the heart and the psyche of American history. This is not a president who should be shown the honor of his portrait hanging in the Oval Office.
Fellow 2020 presidential hopeful Senator Elizabeth Warren was questioned about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
I think of this in two ways. One is the importance of the federal government getting serious about collecting data and making those data publicly available. But the other part is to go back to the issue about tribal sovereignty, about Oliphant, why it is that we need the tribal nations on the front lines, adequately resourced, so that they can provide the first line of defense.
In the afternoon, Senator Amy Klobuchar and Montana Governor Steve Bullock took questions. Bullock appeared via video and spoke about promoting health care and Indian child welfare. In a press conference after the event, Klobuchar said her housing policy addresses Native Americans. In her home state of Minnesota, there are many homeless Native people living in the Twin Cities.
If we're really going to move in a big way on this issue with housing tax credits and making it easier for people to afford housing, we have to do it together as a country.
Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier told Klobuchar flooding on his South Dakota reservation has destroyed aging infrastructure and washed out roads, including on the neighboring Standing Rock Reservation.
Two people lost their lives, but yet I've seen nothing major come down for Indian country as far as infrastructure. So I firmly believe, and I'll stand on that until we get our roads repaired, that the powers to be in the federal government just don't care.
The same question and answer format is underway Tuesday with six more candidates. One of the participants at the Frank LaMare Native American Presidential Forum is polling near the bottom among the candidates, but he picked up an endorsement from a regional tribal consortium. Olivia Reingold reports.
8 out of 8 present members of the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council voted to endorse Montana's Democratic Governor Steve Bullock for president last week. The council is a group of tribal leaders from across Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. Gerald Gray says it was an easy decision when representatives from Bullock's campaign asked for the council's endorsement. Gray chairs the board and is chairman of Montana's Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Cree Indians.
I mean, we can call them today and
and he's got that door open to listen to us and about any kind of issues that we may have.
Gray says Bullock has been a vocal ally in the Little Shell's fight for federal recognition. The tribe, which is currently recognized by the state, has been pushing for federal recognition for the past 4 decades. Gray says other wins, like Bullock's role in passing Montana's Medicaid expansion program, are proof that the governor would do right by Indian country and the nation at large if president. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
And I'm Megan Kamrick.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives has been ordered by a federal judge to disclose data from its Firearms Tracing System database as part of a Freedom of Information Act request. The request was filed by a group called the Every Town for Gun Safety Fund, who requested information on firearms that were recovered by police and traced by the ATF and used in suicides or attempted suicides. The ATF had attempted to cite a congressional provision known as the Tired Act, which was first enacted in 2003 at the urging of the gun lobby and had acted as a shield against the disclosure of gun-related information. However, yesterday, U.S. District Court Judge Allison Nathan ruled in favor of Everytown, saying that the Tired rider does not apply.
For the fourth time in under a week, a potential mass shooter has been arrested. FBI agents apprehended a Florida man, Thomas McVicker, who they say was plotting an attack in the church in Memphis, Alabama. The agency had been tipped off by a friend of McVicker's after a text conversation in which he said he wanted to carry out a mass shooting and was not sure if his target would be a church or just random people on the street. When his friend questioned him as to why he would want to harm innocent people, he responded that they put spiritual spiders and snakes in his bed at night. Agents interviewed McVicker's mother, who informed them that he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, for which he had been prescribed medication. She also said that he was known to use cocaine and methamphetamine. McVicker has been charged with transmission of interstate commerce messages that contain a clear threat to stage a mass shooting. If found guilty, he could face up to 5 years in prison.
City officials in Phoenix, Arizona, announced today that police officers must document every instance in which they point a gun at someone. From now on, Phoenix officers will have to fill out a form anytime they point their gun. The incidents will then be reviewed by a supervisor. This decision comes after public outcry about aggressive police tactics used by city law enforcement. In May, a video taken by civilians in Phoenix showed an officer pull a gun on a family outside a dollar store after their young child took a doll from the shop. City officials have not publicly linked this decision to the May incident. Two separate panels, including the National Police Foundation, recommended that the department record each gun draw. The National Police Foundation made this recommendation after the city of Phoenix asked it to study a 2016 spike in officer-involved shootings. Phoenix is not the first city to require officers to document instances when they point their gun. Other places with similar requirements include Dallas, Baltimore, Cleveland, New Orleans, and Chicago.
A California woman has been arrested for reckless evasion after a bizarre series of events. Initially, Mendocino County Sheriff's deputies were called about a woman who was trespassing on property in the town of Willits. The deputies arrived to find that the woman was gone. After about 3 hours, they received another call saying that the woman had returned and was lying face down in a field. When deputies returned, they found the woman, Jennifer Risch, in the driver's seat of her vehicle. When they approached and tried to speak with her, she drove away. The deputies followed with lights and sirens on, observing that she was driving erratically and with disregard for the safety of pedestrians walking alongside the road. After a chase of about 2 miles, Rich struck a utility pole and plowed through a fence. When the car stopped, she got out and began doing yoga poses. The deputies called for backup and EMTs and did not approach her until they arrived. She was taken to a nearby hospital and later arrested.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Penelope Cruz of the Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association 2. Then at 6, Is It You or Is It Me? And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a high of 68 degrees. Today in history, in 1911, the first around-the-world telegram is sent by the New York Times. The Times wanted to determine how fast a commercial message could be sent by telegraph cable. The message reading, quote, "This message sent around the world left the dispatch room in New York at 7 p.m., traveled more than 28,000 miles, and was received again at the same station 16 and a half minutes later." The quote of the day is from American astronomer and author Carl Sagan, who wrote in his book Cosmos, quote, "If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe." The U.S. tested a new short-range version of the nuclear-capable Tomahawk cruise missile on Sunday. The action comes just weeks after President Trump chose to abandon the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which had served to limit the proliferation of nuclear arms between Russia and the United States. News of Sunday's missile test prompted adverse reactions across the globe, with China's foreign ministry urging the United States to, quote, "exercise restraint in developing new weapons," and warning that such actions could have a negative impact on regional and international security. Similarly, Russia's deputy foreign minister also condemned the launch on Monday, but said that Russia would not deploy any new missiles unless the U.S. did first, adding that Russia would not be provoked into starting a new arms race. However, some fear that the race may already be underway, citing a similar missile test that was held earlier this month in northern Russia.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced his resignation today while attacking his own interior minister in an address to Parliament. Conte accused Interior Minister Matteo Salvini of sinking the ruling coalition and endangering the economy for personal and political gain. Conte said, quote, "Salvini has shown that he is following his own interests and those of his party. His decisions pose serious risks for this country." Less than 2 weeks ago, Salvini declared the coalition led by Conte as unworkable and called for snap elections. Conte, who belongs to neither of the coalition's two parties, called Salvini's actions reckless and, quote, "liable to tip the country into a spiral of political uncertainty and financial instability." Conte said he would hand in his resignation, allowing the head of state to start formal consultations with parties to see if a new coalition can be formed. If this does not occur, President Sergio Mattarella would have to dissolve Parliament 3.5 years ahead of schedule, a move that could trigger elections as early as this fall.
An unknown number of Palestinian protesters were injured Monday night while attempting to block access to Joseph's tomb by hundreds of illegal Israeli settlers. The settlers came to the site, which is in the Palestinian Authority-controlled area, in a convoy of buses escorted by Israeli troops. As the protesters attempted to block access to the tomb, the troops opened fire with rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas canisters. Many protesters were able to receive first aid on the scene for gas inhalation. Settlers regularly invade the tomb, which is located in a densely populated area in the city of Nablus, in the northern area of the West Bank. The sole purpose of these invasions seems to be to provoke anger and chaos among the local residents.
And now it's time for the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen.
It's Tuesday, August 20, 2019.
Some folks are demanding that the mayor of Newark, New Jersey resign. This after high levels of lead have been found in the water there.
Another major city suffers a lead contamination crisis. U.S. fracking boom causing a spike in global methane emissions. Long-term exposure to air pollution is like smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, says new report. Plus,
the reason we've been blocked is because one party that is wedded to moronic refusal to accept science.
2020 Democratic candidate warns Senate filibuster must end to solve the climate crisis.
All of those crises and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Look at the left. Look what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it seem, well, it's for the children, why we need some sort of Green New Deal.
Yeah, the hell with those children who want to survive on a livable planet. Whiners. Am I right, Fox News? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, this is very disturbing news in Newark, New Jersey. It's like Flint all over again.
Yes, unfortunately it is. State officials in New Jersey have requested federal assistance to deal with a growing lead contamination crisis in the water supply of the city of Newark. State and city officials have stepped up delivery of bottled water to residents amid new testing indicating that the extent of lead contamination in Newark's municipal water supply is geographically much broader than previously understood, even in homes that are using special filters. Officials have asked the EPA to boost their limited emergency water supplies and financial resources to address the crisis. Like in Flint, Michigan, the lead contamination is caused by aging lead service lines leaching the toxic lead into drinking water.
Now, in Flint, the officials there actually took an action that caused the type of water that led to the leaching of the lead. Is there a specific action in Newark that caused this, or has this been going on for some time?
They don't know why it has spiked recently, but they do say they must replace their lead service lines.
Yeah.
The Washington Post has published a deep data analysis of temperature records indicating that several regions in the United States have already warmed by nearly 2 degrees Celsius. That's the limit in global temperature rise that nations adopted in the United Nations Paris Climate Accord. The report found that the Northeast is a hotspot. For example, New Jersey and Rhode Island happen to be among the U.S.'s fastest warming states outside of Alaska, and they've already reached the 2 degrees Celsius threshold right now when compared with their temperature data from the late 1800s.
Not good news for New Jersey today.
Nope. The fracking boom in the United States has caused levels of climate warming methane emissions to spike in the Earth's atmosphere. Methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide on shorter timescales, so identifying the source of the spike is really important. Scientists say new data indicates that the huge increase in methane entering the atmosphere over the last 10 years comes primarily from the shale gas fracking boom in the United States and Canada. The Trump administration rolled back Obama-era regulations that required the oil and gas industry to reduce methane leaks from operations. The Trump administration claimed that voluntary industry efforts would suffice.
So how's that working out for you?
Not surprisingly, the new data shows that is not the case. The Trump rollback also costs taxpayers revenue. Drillers don't have to pay millions in royalties every year when they waste natural gas extracted from public lands.
So we lose revenue, but the fossil fuel companies make more profits.
Exactly.
Then I think this is all working out just as planned.
In addition to the climate damage caused by fossil fuel carbon emissions, there's also the costly public health impact. A new study shows that long-term exposure to fossil fuel air pollution in the United States can have the same effect as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. The biggest culprit, the study found, was ground-level ozone, which is generated when vehicle tailpipe exhaust from internal combustion engines chemically reacts with sunlight, a process that gets turbocharged during heat waves. The researchers warn that ground-level ozone levels will continue to increase unless we transition away from fossil fuels.
You know, if you just stopped reading all of these reports, we wouldn't have all of these problems, Des.
They don't go away if you ignore them.
Tell that to the Republicans.
Finally, Washington State Governor and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Jay Inslee on MSNBC said that if he is elected, he will ban fracking. He also excoriated congressional Republicans' denial of climate science and their obstruction of all legislative efforts to rein in fossil fuel emissions. Inslee is also one of the few 2020 Democratic presidential candidates to call for ending the Senate legislative filibuster, if Democrats regain the Senate majority in 2020, if they wish to have a chance at passing any kind of climate legislation.
As soon as we get a president and a Senate and get rid of the filibuster so we can adopt climate change legislation, we'll do what this nation is capable of doing, which is innovating our way to defeat climate change.
Be careful what you wish for, Governor Inslee. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Careful what you wish for, because you just might get it. And if you get it, then you just might not know what to do with it, because it might just come back on you tenfold.
And now from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, a simple change to your thermostat could significantly save energy.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. Set it and forget it. That's how most people manage their home thermostats. But a different approach can save a lot of energy. Jody Smith Anderson is with the Dormitory Authority of the State of New York, a public building agency. At its headquarters, the agency reduced energy use by 40%. Anderson says one effective strategy was to better manage the heating and cooling systems.
The building used to be 73 degrees day in, day out, and the systems were always trying to get us to exactly 73 degrees, no matter what Mother Nature was doing outside.
But now the temperature's allowed to go as low as 68 in winter and up to 78 in summer.
We also changed our dress codes, telling people that they are responsible to some extent for their own comfort within that range. Wear summer clothes in the summer and wear your grandma's winter sweater in the winter. Enjoy that.
She says people can replicate the approach at home.
It's basic logical common sense, but we have worked very hard to tell ourselves that the world should respond to what we want when we want it in the moment we want it. And the world doesn't work that way. So it's a retooling of our own understanding. We need to work with our buildings.
And doing so can benefit your wallet and the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
In the past 3 months, more than 500 million bees have died in Brazil. Beekeepers in four Brazilian states have reported the mass deaths. Bees have an extremely important role in the food chain. About one-third of the food we eat relies on pollination mainly by bees. This includes fruits and vegetables such as avocados, broccoli, and cherries. Researchers are blaming the use of pesticides, the chemical substances used to kill unwanted bugs on crops. The main cause of death is the use of pesticides containing neonicotinoids and fipropinol, products that are banned by the European Union. The EU imposed an almost total ban of neonicotinoids last April because of the serious harm it could cause to the bees. At the same time, Brazil lifted restrictions of pesticides despite opposition from environmentalists. According to Greenpeace, the use of pesticides in Brazil has greatly increased, with 193 products containing chemicals banned in the EU being registered in Brazil in the last 3 years. The country uses so many pesticides because its economy is highly reliant on the agriculture industry. Other countries such as Canada, Mexico, Argentina, and Turkey have also reported mass deaths of bees in the last 18 months.
CurrentCast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, restoring the Muskegon Lake shoreline.
From Mills to Meadows in Muskegon, Michigan, on this CurrentCast. In the 1880s, Muskegon was known as the lumber queen of the Midwest.
Around Muskegon Lake, where it enters Lake Michigan, there were 47 sawmills.
That's Kathy Evans of the West Michigan Shoreline Regional Development Commission. She says other industries set up shop along the lake, too, replacing natural lakefront ecosystems with a hardened shoreline dominated by wood pilings, foundry slag, and concrete. But Evans Group has worked to restore more than 10,000 feet of shoreline. They've removed old industrial debris, added healthy soil, and planted native species, creating habitats where wildlife can thrive once more. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
So we're here today with Penelope Cruz of the Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association 2, discussing the group, its goals, and what its upcoming meeting is all about. Hi, Penelope.
Hi, how are you? Feel free to call me Bird.
Bird, hi, I will. Thank you, Bird. Could you tell us more about your group, what it does, and what's its purpose?
So Emmanuel Displaced Persons 2 is actually an acronym for Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association. Two, and we're the descendants of the original EDPA, which was formed in 1970 by Mrs. Leo Warren. And the purpose of the original EDPA was to protest the egregious demolishing of black homes in the central Albina area. And as a result, Ms. Leo Warren in the original EDPA were able to stop federal funding for the expansion of the Emmanuel Hospital until an agreement was reached. Ultimately, an agreement was reached. It was signed by the City of Portland, PDC, as well as Emmanuel Hospital and EDPA. In that agreement, everyone agreed that every home that was demolished would be replaced. That has not happened. And so EDPA 2, the descendants, are picking up that work.
And so what you're talking about, this incident, it occurred in 1972, correct? Can you tell our listeners a little more about what happened to this community because of the hospital?
Tell us about that fight a little bit in 1972.
What happened is when the hospital was built, it set into place a very intentional plan to rid central Albina of an overwhelmingly black community that was on the move and was making progress. A lot of times when you hear the history of this story, it's caged in stereotypes, blight, ran down neighborhoods. I present a view to the contrary of that. Black people were on the rise, and every decade it just got better and better. And so I'll give you an example. During the 1940s, black people sort of flexed their political will by protesting outside of City Hall, as well as a Portland Housing Authority, because a month after Vanport, because they didn't have anywhere to go. Rents were too high. People had saved money from working in Vanport. They had acquired skills. Also, during the 1940s, the Popular White Flag Company hired black people. The Fair Employment Practices Act was passed. So there was a lot of stuff going on in the 40s as well as the 50s. The 50s, I call the 1950s for Portland's black central Albina community, 50s first. Because during the 50s, you had the first black high school teacher. You had the first black deputy commissioner in the Fair Employment Practices Division. You had the first black fireman. You had the first black highway engineer. I mean, it just goes on and on. And so by the 60s, you had a pretty solid black community that was self-sufficient and independent. In 1963, Ira Keller, the head of PDC, made a statement that he was concerned with the concentration of black folks in central Albina and that a black ghetto, he wanted to stop the creation of a black ghetto. And so the Emmanuel Hospital expansion was used to stop the progress of a burgeoning black community.
So the building of the hospital was a direct attack on the black community in that area.
Definitely.
Did it have something to do with the home ownership within the black community that and their ability to participate because of that?
So when you talk about community, what is a community? In my estimation, a community is its ownership and its control. You don't have community without ownership and control. Central Albina, black community, had both. It was a threat.
So when they removed those, the people living there to make that project, what kind of impact, what happened to those people?
Well, one area of my research that I really would like to develop is I discovered several people who died shortly after being relocated. You have to understand, when we talk about the residents of Central Albina at that time, we're talking about an overwhelmingly population of elderly people. They had been in their homes 25, 30 years. A lot of them were retired on fixed incomes. So the impact is what I began to notice is people died shortly after being relocated. Some people moved out just moved out of Portland altogether and moved into other areas. But ultimately, it retarded the economic and social process and split the black money up into areas that people moved to. So you don't have a centralized black economic center anymore. And so when people have a tendency to talk about gentrification as just the movement of bodies, gentrification is about the movement of money. And if you aren't reversing economic conditions, you aren't reversing gentrification.
And so with reversing these conditions, I know that there were some promises made by the hospital and the people in charge of this. Can you go into those promises, whether or not they were upheld, and what's kind of become of that?
Well, the promise that EDPA 2 is narrowly focused on is in the agreement, it says every home that you demolish, you will replace within close proximity of the hospital. That has never happened.
Do you know, have any of the homes at all been replaced, or any members of the communities been?
No.
No, not at all.
Are the homes that they are supposed to build based on this agreement, is there any intention for those homes to go back towards displaced persons or the descendants of them?
That would be great, wouldn't it? wouldn't that be wonderful? If folks fulfill the agreement that they signed?
I think that would be appreciated.
Yeah.
To uphold a contract.
I think so.
So would you say, for, I know you guys are two, kind of the secondary evolution of this group,
sure,
would you say that that is your main focus now?
I would say that progressive reclamation is the main focus of EDPA 2. And to be more specific, so the purpose for Saturday's meeting is to inform the descendants of an opportunity that has come my way. And I have to admit, it's a bit attractive, but I want to hear from the descendants to see what they think. It's major, it's very unique, and there's a guest speaker who will be at the Saturday meeting, August 24th at 3 p.m. at Billy Webb Elks Lodge, located at 6 North Tillamook.
And is this meeting open for everyone or just descendants?
We are focusing on descendants. Descendants of the Emanuel Hospital expansion displacement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And will they be given an opportunity to speak, or will it mostly be kind of hearing about the group?
Information will be presented, and then folks will have a Q&A. But I need to be extremely clear. It's an opportunity to derive sort of a direct benefit for the descendants. It's a huge meeting. It's very important. I know if I am a descendant, but if I heard of this as a descendant, I would definitely attend.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like an interesting opportunity for people to get ideas together in order to move this forward.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going to be going on at that meeting?
This is what's going to happen. I'm going to present. A special guest is going to present. There's going to be a Q&A. There's going to be an opportunity. And for folks who want all the details.
Will there be snacks?
there may be catered food.
There
yes.
might be snacks.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so what do you think that I know we've talked about community, the definition, what would you consider this new community of descendants to be? Is it just the direct descendants of those people that lived in the area, or would you expand it beyond that?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but this is what I know. EDPA 2 is narrowly focused on descendants of the displaced because of the Emanuel Hospital expansion.
Do you have any numbers on how many homes were displaced, how many people were affected by this?
I get asked that question all the time, and here's my answer. There is no definitive number, and here's why. So Emanuel subversively acquired property for 10 years without folks knowing. Rumors began to spread. People moved out. And prior to 1969, they did not keep records of the homes that were demolished. They did not have a property identification process. So your home could have been demolished. And then in 1970 is when they really did deeper
heavy
tracking.
Campaign.
Yeah. So your home could have been demolished, and it's not in the official historical record.
But if someone, let's say there was someone whose family history tells them that they are a descendant, and they hearing KBOO right now and listening to you and want to show up to your meeting, but they might have that exact story where maybe all they have is a few family photographs from them, grandparents, great grandparents. Could they effectively use family history, data? Could they bring that forward to help create a claim?
That's an excellent question. One that I was not prepared to answer, but I'll answer. So this is what happened. EDPA 2, as I was out in the field doing research, I actually uncovered some of these folks. And what I did is I made an agreement with the City of Portland Archive. I got in contact with them because I've already, you know, had been working with them. And I said, "There, I'm finding addresses that are not in the official record. As I find these addresses, are you willing to enter them?" And they said, "Yeah." So I have a list of addresses that I'm going to submit to the Portland City Archive.
That's pretty interesting. Are you guys going to be making an archive project out of this for, like, educational purposes?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
I feel like I've heard of this story at some point before here, and people have talked about that in the history of Emmanuel. But it doesn't get talked about too often.
And when it is, it's ameliorated, right? It's this cute little kind of story like, oh, there was some damage. You know, this was very intentional. It was very intentional, and it was ugly.
Does the hospital itself, do they say anything about their history or their past? Have they ever apologized or even said anything about this?
So I don't like to try to speak for Emmanuel. They had a luncheon.
Oh,
they had
great.
A luncheon in 2012.
And that's about it?
That's all you're aware of at the moment?
That's all that I'll say. I can't speak for Emmanuel Hospital.
Interesting. Where can people go if they want to find out more about this? Like, if they want to find out more about how that all went down in 1972, and they just want to learn the history?
They can contact me, definitely. I lecture on this topic. I have a lot of historical records and documents that you just cannot find. I can be reached. My email address is Black. So it's Lil Miss Blackbird at yahoo.com. So that's LilMiss, the color black, BLACK, bird, BYRD, at yahoo.com.
At yahoo.com. Interesting.
And then are you hoping to increase other public awareness? I know that you want the descendants specifically to come out to this, but would it be helpful for other people in Portland to be aware of this history and support you?
Definitely,
in some way.
Because Portland has a way of just making history so sweet, and it's not a sweet history at all. It's not a sweet history, and it's okay to tell the truth. It's okay to tell the truth about what happened. It was ugly. Folks are responsible.
Would you say that, I mean, this project and the changing of the demographic in the area of removing the black community, how much of an impact do you think that might have had in the diversity in this city and the way that the city has grown? Do you think that was a major part of it, just one of many things? Or do you think it was like a really like tipping point that kept helping change everything?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I was wondering about it, if you think this was like a really big thing that helped alter the diversity that we have here in our city by changing where the communities and where the black communities are living by having pushed this out. Do you think this was like one of the more serious events in Portland history?
It was definitely a serious event. It shattered Portland's black community, splintered it. It was definitely a major event.
And you think they're still having a hard time recovering?
Well, that's not the only event. And we always talk about gentrification and the uprooting of black folks like it stopped with the Emmanuel Hospital expansion, when we know that that's not true. The Interstate Urban Corridor has done a tremendous job of moving folks out. Efforts that are going on right now today in the midst of correcting past harms, right, are still doing this. So it's an ongoing thing. I don't speak of this in a finality.
And with these ongoing issues, is there any way that people in Portland can help or stop this from happening or do anything, really?
I mean, do you recommend that they form a group like you've done? Do you recommend that they just sort of seek out community engagement and as much information as possible?
First of all, people need to tell the truth. First of all, people need to tell the truth. How about that? Let's start with the truth. Mm-hmm. That's all I would have to say about that.
Well, I would like to thank you for being here today, Bird.
No problem.
I'm not sure if you have anything else you would like to share with the listeners. You want to remind them perhaps of the details of the event?
Saturday, August 24th at the Billy Webb Elks Lodge, located at 6 North Tillamook, 3 p.m. If you are a descendant of the displaced because of the Emmanuel Hospital expansion, please come prepared to either share the name of your family or the address in which your family was displaced.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
You've been listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. This has been a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's Rising Up with Sonali. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Food Show talks with experts about what to eat and how to plan meals on your summer camping and backpacking adventures. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. Become a member today by going to KBOO.fm and click on Donate.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at The Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What might an artist near the end of a well-lived life tell us about the creative process and the personal qualities or values they think are important for living a good life? Hi, I'm Bob Madar, inviting you to come on over to Local Folks Podcast for our last visit with Mickey and listen to him talk about what he has learned after 96 years on the planet. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It is almost 6 o'clock, and next up is It You or Is It Me with your host Guinevere and her guest. Stay tuned.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Guinevere D'Amblia. It is, we are at KBOO, KBOO 97.7, Portland. I have with me tonight Jen Burlton. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you
so much for coming on.
Guinevere, my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be invited to join you, and this is no different.
Yeah. So, you have come into Is It You or Is It Me? Is our show, and our episode tonight is Truth, Lies, and the Space in Between. Mm-hmm.